good one, however, because it is impossible to answer in the affirmative. We have no chance, even in principle, of exploring the entire universe, which extends way beyond the visible horizon 46 billion light-years away. The answer can never, therefore, be yes with certainty. Indeed, if the universe is infinite in extent, we have our answer. No, we are not alone. The laws of nature self-evidently allow life to exist, and no matter how improbable, life must have arisen an infinite number of times. In itself, this is quite a challenging statement, and we will explore it in more detail later on. But this isn't really what most of us want to know. I've always been interested in aliens, the ones that fly spaceships around, and I want to talk to one. On a winter afternoon in 1977, I stood in a queue that went around three sides of the Odeon Cinema in Oldham with my dad, shuffling through half-frozen puddles to see Star Wars, and spent the next decade building Millennium Falcons out of Lego. At some point in 1979, I picked up a magazine about Alien and moved on to Nostromo, which required more bricks. To my delight, I saw Alien when I was 11 years old at Friday Evening Film Society at school, and it didn't put me off. I just realised I really liked the spaceships and didn't care much about the organic stuff. Everyone should see Alien at 11. To hell with the ratings. Terror, technology and Sigourney Weaver are good for the soul. Science fiction was a natural home for my imagination. I'd been interested in astronomy for a while. I'm not sure why, but the study of the stars seemed clean and precise and romantic. Something done on cold nights before Christmas with mittens and imagination. Star Wars, Star Trek, Alien, Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov were merged seamlessly with Patrick Moore, Carl Sagan and James Burke, and they remain so. Fact and fiction are inseparable in dreams. The superficially orthogonal desires to do science and to imagine distant worlds are closely related, shadows cast by different lights. So the question, are we alone in the universe, might make good science fiction, but it is not well posed in a scientific sense because the universe is too big for us to explore in its entirety. If we restrict the domain of the question, however, we can address it scientifically. Are we alone in the solar system is a question we are actively seeking to answer with Mars rovers and future missions to the moons of Jupiter and Saturn, where the conditions necessary for life may be present on multiple worlds. But even here, the use of the word alone in the question is problematic. Would we be alone if the universe were full of microbes? Would you feel alone, stranded in a deep cave with no means of escape and a billion bacteria for company? If not being alone means having intelligent beings to communicate with, sophisticated creatures that build civilizations, have feelings, do science and respond emotionally to the universe, then we have our answer in the solar system. Yes. Earth is the only world that is home to a civilization, and we are alone. How far might we reasonably expect to extend the domain of our question beyond the solar system? I find it impossible to believe that we'll ever explore the universe beyond our own galaxy. The distance between the Milky Way and our nearest neighbour, Andromeda, is over 2 million light-years, and that seems to me to be an unbridgeable distance, at least given the known laws of physics. But that still leaves an island of several hundred billion stars, 100,000 light-years across. We will therefore rephrase our question so that we have a chance of interrogating it in a scientific way and ask, are we the only intelligent civilization in the Milky Way galaxy? If the answer is yes, then we are in the cosmic equivalent of an inescapable cave, and that would have made my 11-year-old self gazing up at a dark sky of infinite possibilities extremely sad. There may be others out there amongst the distant galaxies, but we'll never know. If the answer is no, on the other hand, this would have profound consequences. Aliens would exist in a truly science fiction sense, beings with spacecraft, culture, religion, art, beliefs, hopes and dreams out there amongst the stars, waiting for us to speak with them. What are the chances of that? We don't know. But at least we have posed a question that can be explored scientifically. How many intelligent civilizations are there likely to be in the Milky Way given the available evidence today. The First Aliens. On the 24th of June 1947, Ken Arnold, an amateur pilot from Scobie, Montana, was flying over Mount Rainier, one of the most dangerous volcanoes in the world. Arnold was an experienced pilot with thousands of flying hours, and this implied he was a trustworthy observer. On returning to the airfield, he claimed to have seen nine objects flying in the mountain skies, describing them as flat like a pie pan and like a big flat disc. He estimated that the discs were flying in formation at speeds of up to 1,920 kilometers per hour. The press jumped on the story, coining the term flying saucer, and within weeks, hundreds of similar sightings were reported from all over the world. On the 4th of July, a United Airlines crew reported seeing another formation of nine discs over the skies of Idaho, and 4 days later, the mother of all UFO stories exploded at Roswell, New Mexico, with the confirmation and then rapid retraction by the United States Air Force of a recovered flying disc, an alien craft crash-landed on Earth. I'll put my cards on the table here. I believe in UFOs. That is to say, I believe that there have been sightings of flying things in the sky that the observers were unable to identify, some of which were objects. But I do not believe for a moment that these were spacecraft flown by aliens. Occam's razor is an important tool in science. It shouldn't be oversold. Nature can be complex and bizarre. But as a rule of thumb, it is most sensible to adopt the simplest explanation for an observation until the evidence overwhelms it. My favourite response to the criticism that dismissing the possibility of alien visitations to Earth is unscientific was provided by physicist and Nobel laureate Richard Feynman in his Messenger lectures at Cornell University in 1964. Some years ago, I had a conversation with a layman about flying saucers. Because I am scientific, I know all about flying saucers. I said, I don't think there are flying saucers. So my antagonist said, is it impossible that there are flying saucers? Can you prove that it's impossible? No, I said, I can't prove it's impossible. It's just very unlikely. At that, he said, you are very unscientific. If you can't prove it impossible, then how can you say that it's unlikely? But that is the way that is scientific. It is scientific only to say what is more likely and what less likely, and not to be proving all the time the possible and impossible. To define what I mean, I might have said to him, listen, I mean that from my knowledge of the world that I see around me, I think that it is much more likely that the reports of flying saucers are the results of the known irrational characteristics of terrestrial intelligence than of the unknown rational efforts of extraterrestrial intelligence. It is just more likely. That is all. Irrespective of the veracity of the stories of mutilated cows, crop circles, and violated Midwesterners at the hands of these alien visitors, the cultural impact of these early sightings was very real. America quickly entered into a media-fueled love affair with alien invaders in shiny discs, brandishing anal probes. Why didn't they use MRI scanners, a non-Freudian would surely ask. Of all the hundreds of thousands of references to flying saucers that began to appear in the media, a cartoon by Alan Dunn, published in the New Yorker magazine on the 20th of May 1950, found its way into the lunchtime conversation of a group of scientists at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. Enrico Fermi was one of the greatest 20th century physicists. Italian by birth, he conducted his most acclaimed work in the United States, having left his native country with his Jewish wife Laura in 1938 as Mussolini's grip tightened. Fermi worked on the Manhattan Project throughout World War II, first at Los Alamos, and then at the University of Chicago, where he was responsible for Chicago Pile 1, the world's first nuclear reactor. In a squash court underneath a disused sports stadium in December 1942, Fermi oversaw the first man-made nuclear chain reaction, paving the way for the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. After the war, Fermi settled as a professor in Chicago, but he often visited Los Alamos. During one of these visits in the summer of 1950, Fermi settled down for lunch with a group of colleagues including Edward Teller, the architect of the hydrogen bomb, and fellow Manhattan Project alumni Herbert York and Emil Konopinski. At some point, talk turned to the recent reports of UFO sightings and the New Yorker cartoon, stimulating Fermi to ask a simple question that turned a trivial conversation into a serious discussion. Where are they? Fermi's question is a powerful and challenging one that deserves an answer. It has become known as the Fermi paradox. There are hundreds of billions of star systems in the Milky Way galaxy. Our solar system is around 4.6 billion years old, but the galaxy is almost as old as the universe. If we assume life is relatively common, and on at least some of these planets intelligent civilizations arose, it follows that there should exist civilizations far in advance of our own, somewhere in the galaxy. Why? Our civilization has existed for around 10,000 years, and we've had access to modern technology for a few hundred. Our species, Homo sapiens, has existed for a quarter of a million years or so. This is a blink of an eye in comparison to the age of the Milky Way. So if we assume we are not the only civilization in the galaxy, then at least a few others must have arisen billions of years ahead of us. But where are they? The distances are not so vast that we cannot imagine travelling between star systems in principle. It took us less than a single human lifetime to go from the Wright brothers to the moon. What might we imagine doing in the next 100 years, or 1,000 years, or 10,000 years, or 10 million years? Even with rocketry technology as currently imagined, we could colonize the entire galaxy on million-year timescales. The Fermi paradox simply boils down to the question of why nobody has done this, given so many billions of worlds and so many billions of years. It is a very good question. Listen very carefully. For 3 days in 1924, William F. Friedman had a very important job. As chief cryptographer to the U.S. Army, Friedman was used to dealing with national security responsibilities, but from the 21st to the 23rd of August, he was asked to search for an unusual message. On these dates, Mars and Earth came within 56 million kilometres of each other, the closest the two planets had been since 1845, and they would not be so close again until August 2003. This offered the best opportunity since the invention of radio to listen in on the neighbours. To make the most of the planetary alignment, scientists at the United States Naval Observatory decided to conduct an ambitious experiment. Coordinated across the United States, they conducted a National Radio Silence Day, with every radio in the country quietened for 5 minutes on the hour every hour, across a 36-hour period. With this unprecedented radio silence, and a specially designed radio receiver mounted on an airship, the idea was to make the most of the Martian flyby and listen in for messages, intentional or otherwise, from the Red Planet. Conspiracy theories notwithstanding, William F. Friedman didn't decipher the first message from an alien intelligence, and the American public soon tired of the disruption to their news bulletins, but the principle of the experiment was sound. The idea that we might listen in to aliens had first been proposed 30 years earlier by the physicist and engineer Nikola Tesla. Tesla suggested that a version of his wireless electrical transmission system could be used to contact beings from Mars, and subsequently presented evidence of first contact. He wasn't right, but in 1896, 1 year before the publication of War of the Worlds, it was certainly a plausible claim. Tesla wasn't alone. Other luminaries of the time shared his optimism, including the pioneer of long-distance radio transmission, Guglielmo Marconi, who believed that listening to the neighbours would become a routine part of modern communication. By 1921, Marconi was publicly stating that he had intercepted wireless messages from Mars, and if only the codes could be deciphered, conversation would soon begin. The failure of the National Radio Silence Day brought a temporary halt to the organised search for extraterrestrial signals, and the idea dropped out of scientific fashion until the post-war flying saucer boom. One of the first scientists to make the search for ET scientifically acceptable again was Philip Morrison, a contemporary and colleague of Fermi. It's not known whether they discussed the Fermi paradox directly, but the idea of answering it certainly played on Morrison's mind throughout the 1950s. At the end of the decade, Morrison published a famous and influential paper with another of Fermi's collaborators, Giuseppe Cocconi, laying out the principles of using radio telescopes to listen for signals. Searching for Interstellar Communications was published in the prestigious journal Nature and proposed a systematic search of the nearest star systems on a very specific radio frequency, the so-called 21-centimetre hydrogen line. Hydrogen atoms consist of two particles, a single proton bound to a single electron. Protons and electrons have a property called spin, which for these particular particles, known as spin half fermions, named after Enrico Fermi himself, can take only one of two values, often called spin up and spin down. There are therefore only two possible configurations of the spins in a hydrogen atom. The spins can be parallel to each other, both up or both down, or anti-parallel, one up and one down. It turns out that the parallel case has slightly more energy than the anti-parallel case, and when the spin configuration flips from parallel to anti-parallel, this extra energy is carried away as a photon of light with a wavelength of 21 centimetres. Morrison and Cocconi chose the hydrogen line because it's a frequency that any technological civilization interested in astronomy will be tuned into. Hydrogen is the most abundant element in the universe, and hydrogen atoms emit radio waves at precisely this frequency. If we could see these wavelengths with our eyes, the sky would be aglow, and this is why astronomers tune their radio telescopes to the 21-centimetre line, to map the distribution of dust and gas in our galaxy and beyond. If a technological civilization wants to be heard, then under the assumption that anyone with any sense does radio astronomy, the 21-centimetre line would be the most obvious choice for a message. Morrison and Cocconi's paper inspired the birth of one of the most widely debated and controversial astronomical projects of modern times. Within a year of its publication, the 85-foot radio telescope at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, was pointing towards two nearby stars, Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, listening in to the 21-centimeter hydrogen line for any signs of unnatural order in the signals from the stars. The project, known as OSMA, after a character from L. Frank Baum's Land of Oz, was the brainchild of Frank Drake, a young astronomer from Cornell University. Drake chose Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani as the first target star systems because of the stars' similarity to our own Sun and their proximity, just 10 and 12 light-years away from Earth. In 1960, Drake had no idea if these stars harbored planetary systems because no planets had been detected outside our solar system at that time. We now know that Drake's guess was a good one. Tau Ceti is thought to have five planets orbiting the star, with one of them in the habitable zone. Epsilon Eridani is also thought to have at least one gas giant planet with an orbital period of around 7 years. After 150 hours of observation, Drake heard nothing. But for him, this was the beginning of a lifetime dedicated to the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, a search commonly known by its acronym, SETI. Today, SETI is a global scientific effort, analyzing data from telescopes used primarily for radio astronomy. The organization also has a dedicated collection of telescopes designed specifically to detect signals from extraterrestrial civilizations at the Hat Creek Radio Observatory near San Francisco. The Allen Array, named after Microsoft founder Paul Allen, who donated over $30 million to fund the construction of the project, consists of 42 radio antennae able to scan large areas of the sky at multiple radio frequencies, including the 21-centimeter hydrogen line. If there are any civilizations making a serious attempt to contact us with technology at least as advanced as our own within 1,000 light years, the Allen Array will hear them. In the early 1960s, the scientific community was skeptical about such endeavors, and Frank Drake was perceived as a maverick. It's important to be skeptical in science, but as Fermi understood, a back-of-the-envelope calculation with some plausible assumptions suggests that the search for ET may not be futile. Indeed, the alternative view that our civilization is unique or extremely rare in a galaxy of 100 billion suns appears outrageously solipsistic, and the skeptical finger might as easily be pointed at the cynics. There was, however, a handful of scientists who understood the importance of asking big questions, and together with Peter Pearman, a senior scientist at America's prestigious National Academy of Sciences, Drake organized the first SETI conference in November 1961. The Green Bank meeting was small, but the list of attendees, who named themselves the Order of the Dolphin, was impressive. Philip Morrison was there, as was his co-author of the seminal 1959 Nature paper, Giuseppe Cocconi. I have a professional connection with Cocconi, who was a noted particle physicist and director of the Proton Synchrotron Accelerator at CERN in Geneva. Cocconi was instrumental in discovering early experimental evidence for the Pomeron, an object in particle physics known as a Regi trajectory that I have spent most of my career studying. The eminent, highly respected astronomer Otto Struve also attended. Struve publicly stated his belief in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life, perhaps because he had recently suggested a method for detecting alien planets outside our solar system. Nobel laureate Melvin Calvin, most famous for his work on photosynthesis, was present, along with future Hewlett-Packard Vice President for R&D Barney Oliver, astronomer Sushu Huang, communications specialist Dana Achley, and the colourful neuroscientist and dolphin researcher John Lilly. The most junior attendee was a 27-year-old postdoc called Carl Sagan. I would love to have been there, although I'd have spent the whole time chatting with Cocconi about Pomerons. In preparation for the meeting, Drake drew up an agenda designed to stimulate a structured conversation amongst the group. If the search for intelligent extraterrestrial life was to be taken seriously, it was clear in Drake's mind that the discussion should be rigorous and provide a framework for future research. The way to do that is to address the problem quantitatively rather than qualitatively, to break it down into a series of probabilities that can be estimated, at least in principle, using observational data. Drake focused on a well-defined question, the one we discussed above. How many intelligent civilizations exist in the Milky Way galaxy that we could, in principle, communicate with? Drake's brilliant insight was to express this in terms of a simple equation containing a series of probabilities. What is the fraction of stars in the galaxy that have planets? What is the average number of planets around a star that could support life? What is the fraction of those planets on which life begins? What is the probability that, given the emergence of simple life, intelligent life evolves? Given intelligence, how likely is it that the intelligent beings build radio telescopes and are therefore capable of communicating with us? Multiply all those probabilities together, and multiply by the number of stars in the Milky Way, and you get a number. The number of intelligent civilizations that have ever existed in the Milky Way. This isn't all Drake did, however, because he was interested in the number of civilizations that we might be able to speak to now. And that requires the addition of a rather thought-provoking term. The average lifetime of civilizations from the moment they develop the technology to communicate. If a civilization arose a billion years ago and vanished shortly afterwards, then we would never be able to talk to them. The question of the lifetime of a civilization may have been more vivid in the early 1960s than it is today. The Manhattan Project had been the training ground for many of the great physicists, and the Cuban Missile Crisis was less than a year away, propelling the world, in Soviet Premier Khrushchev's words to President Kennedy, towards the abyss of a world nuclear missile war. To me, and to the participants at the Green Bank Conference, the idea that a civilization might destroy itself is both ludicrous and likely. We are pathetically inadequate at long-term planning, idiotically primitive in our destructive urges, and pathologically incapable of simply getting along. More of this later. Putting the lifetime term into the equation was therefore scientifically valid and a political masterstroke. Merely confronting the question should give us pause for thought at the very least. To complete the equation with the lifetime term included, recall that it should give the number of currently contactable civilizations in the Milky Way. A little thought will convince you that the whole lot must be multiplied by the current rate of star formation in the galaxy. That might not be immediately obvious, but I have confidence you can demonstrate to yourself that it's the correct thing to do. Homework is good. The completed equation, which is known as the Drake equation, is as follows. N equals R star times FS times FP times NE times FL times FI times FC times L, where N is the number of civilizations in our galaxy with which radio communication might be possible, i.e. which are on our current past light cone. R star is the average rate of star formation in our galaxy. FP is the fraction of those stars that have planets. NE is the average number of planets that can potentially support life per star that has planets. FL is the fraction of planets that could support life that actually develop life at some point. FI is the fraction of planets with life that actually go on to develop intelligent life, civilizations. FC is the fraction of civilizations that develop a technology that releases detectable signs of their existence into space. And L is the length of time for which such civilizations release detectable signals into space. When Drake wrote down his equation, only R star was known with precision. Star formation had been closely studied in parts of our galaxy, and the data suggested a value of around one new star per year. The rest of the terms were unknown in the 1960s, and we will spend the majority of this chapter exploring them, given over 50 years of astronomical and biological research. Despite the lack of experimental data, however, the Green Bank participants spent the meeting debating each one of the terms in the Drake equation. This is the power of Drake's formulation. It's not yet possible to make a measurement of the fraction of planets on which life emerges with any sort of precision. But it is possible to look at the experience we have on Earth, and increasingly in the wider solar system, and make an informed guess. The probability of the emergence of intelligence given simple life is also a difficult question, but we do know that it took over 3 billion years on Earth, and that may give us a clue. Drake's equation is valuable, therefore, because it provides a framework for discussion and debate, focuses the mind, and suggests a direction for future research, just as Drake intended. The Green Bank meeting did produce a consensus number, based on the not inconsiderable expertise of the participants. There are of the order of 10,000 civilizations present now in the Milky Way, with whom we could communicate if we had enough radio telescopes and the will to conduct a systematic search. Interestingly, Philip Morrison, veteran of the Manhattan Project, felt that the lifetime of technological civilizations may be so short that this number could well be zero, although he observed that, if we never search, the chance of success is zero. I had the privilege of meeting Frank Drake during the filming of Human Universe. In my view, he is one of the greatest living astronomers. Frank collects and cultivates orchids, and by complete coincidence, I arrived at his house when his Stanhopia orchid was flowering. These delicate and complex flowers bloom for only 2 days every year, and the chance of seeing one on a random visit is therefore small. Frank turned to me and said, "Well, so it is with SETI. We've learned that we must search over and over and over through the years until we are in the right place at the right time to make the discovery. There is hope in its name, and there is nothing wrong at all with admitting a dash of hope." Throughout the 1960s and 1970s, SETI projects, both big and small, continued to develop across the planet. Soviet scientists joined their American contemporaries in pointing radio receivers to the sky in the hope of detecting a signal in the noise. NASA considered funding Project Cyclops, a $10 billion super array of 1,500 dishes that could listen for signals originating up to 1,000 light-years from Earth. It never progressed beyond the planning stage, but the scale of the project demonstrates that SETI was considered to be a serious scientific endeavor. By the mid-1970s, various projects had come and gone, but none had detected the faintest hint of a significant signal. This failure, combined with a lack of progress in pinning down any of the terms in the Drake equation — it was not even certain that planets existed in large numbers beyond our solar system — made the search look increasingly futile. Not only was there a deafening silence, no one had much idea where to look or how hard to listen. NASA didn't lose faith, however, and in 1973, Ohio University's 10-year-old Big Ear telescope was optimized for a SETI survey and began taking data. 4 years later, on the 18th of August 1977, Jerry R. Amon, then a volunteer at the Big Ear, received a knock on the door of his house. It was a Thursday morning, and as usual, standing at the door was a technician carrying reams of paper printouts. This was an age when a state-of-the-art hard disk could hold only a couple of megabytes, and every few days someone had to visit the telescope, print out the data, and wipe the disks clean. Eamon put the 3 days' worth of printed data on his kitchen table and began searching. He was confronted with dozens of pages covered in hundreds of letters and numbers. The list of numbers and letters depicts the strength of the signal hitting the telescope at different times. A space denotes low intensity, and higher intensities are registered as numbers from 0 to 9. For stronger signals still, letters between A and Z are used. Most of the data the Big Ear recorded contained no letters. A stream of ones and twos signified sweeps across the general radio hiss of the sky. That morning, however, Eamon stumbled across something different. At approximately 10:16 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the 15th of August, a radio pulse of extreme intensity entered the antennae, recorded with the alphanumeric code 6EQUJ5. The signal lasted for 72 seconds, precisely the length of time a transmission of distant origin would register as the rotation of the Earth swept the telescope past the source. This is extremely important. If the signal had been caused by some kind of Earth-based interference, it would be highly unlikely to rise and fall in this manner, precisely and coincidentally simulating the rotation of the Earth and the telescope's field of view on the sky. The peak was marked by the letter U, the strongest signal ever recorded by the Big Ear, denoting an intensity over 30 times that of the background emission of the galaxy. Equally strangely, the signal had a wavelength of 21 centimetres, the hydrogen line favoured by Morrison and Cocconi in their 1959 Nature paper. A smoking gun for extraterrestrial communication? With a now famous flourish, Eamon circled the six characters and scribbled "Wow" on the printout. He then continued as a research scientist should, and looked to see if it happened again. He flicked through page after page, but the event of 10:16 p.m. on the 15th of August was a solitary blip in the background noise. This presented a problem, because it should have happened again. The Big Ear telescope scans each part of the sky twice, separated by 3 minutes, so there should have been a similar wow signal in the data 3 minutes afterwards. None was present. This doesn't rule out an intelligent extraterrestrial origin. Perhaps ET just turned the transmitter off a minute or so after it was first detected. Who knows? The origin of the wow signal was narrowed down to a point in the sky in the direction of the constellation Sagittarius. Tau Sagittarii, a stable orange star twice the mass of our Sun and around 122 light-years away, is the closest bright star to the source. Since August 1977, multiple attempts have been made to recover the signal using the world's most sensitive radio telescopes. Many hours have been spent listening, but nothing unusual has ever been detected again. Today, over 35 years later, there is no satisfactory explanation. But no serious scientist, no matter how embedded in SETI, would claim it as definitive evidence of intelligent extraterrestrial communication. Scientific results have to be repeatable, and the observation has never been repeated. For the moment, the wow signal remains an interesting anomaly in an otherwise silent sky. It is the stuff of dreams, the faintest of whispers in a great silence. The Golden Voyage. 2 days after Jerry Eamon spotted the wow signal, the human race responded with a long-planned contribution to the interstellar conversation. In an explosive, serendipitous moment, the Voyager 2 spacecraft blasted into the sky above Space Launch Complex 41 at Kennedy Space Center, followed 2 weeks later by its twin Voyager 1. The Voyager missions were designed to take advantage of a rare planetary alignment to study the outer solar system gas giants Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. I remember the launch. I'd collected a series of PG Tips tea cards called The Race into Space, in which the Grand Tour mission was described as the most ambitious unmanned space project known. Using the newly proposed gravity assist, a spacecraft could accelerate around Jupiter, Saturn, and Uranus to encounter Neptune only a decade from launch. The voyagers delivered, I suspect, way beyond their designers' wildest dreams, returning the first detailed pictures of the esoteric moons of Jupiter and Saturn, and in the case of Voyager 2, sweeping onwards to become the only spacecraft to date to visit Uranus and Neptune, where it photographed the distant ice moon Triton in the summer of 1989. At the time of writing, on the 8th of July 2014, Voyager 1 is the most distant man-made object, at over 127 astronomical units from Earth, so distant that radio waves take over 17 and a half hours to reach it. This puts Voyager 1 at the very edge of the solar system, on its way into interstellar space. The bus-sized spacecraft has enough electrical power to continue to communicate with its home world until around 2020, at which point it will fall silent. In 40,000 years, it will drift within 1.6 light-years of the red dwarf star Gliese 445 in the constellation of Camelopardalis. Voyager 2 will reach Sirius, the brightest star in the night sky, in 296,000 years. The voyagers are accompanied on their lonely flights out of our solar system by a dream, an unusually sentimental and hopeful afterthought to a scientific mission bolted to their sides almost 40 years ago. The Voyager Golden Record is our message in a bottle, an old-fashioned phonograph record constructed of gold-plated copper floating through the universe. It contains what some would term a surreal mixture of sound recordings, images, and information. It was designed to provide an alien civilization with information about who we are, what we know, and what our planet is like. There are 116 images on the disc. The first 30 or so are scientific, illustrating our solar system, our home world, the structure of DNA, the anatomy of our bodies, our reproduction, and our birth. Anatomy takes up more room than any other subject, perhaps reflecting our own fascination with what aliens might look like. In the most magnificently colloquial and futile gesture towards the aliens' moral sensibilities, no nudity was allowed. I find it hard enough to imagine the inner workings of alien brains, but I cannot begin to fathom what it must be like inside the mind of a person who raised such an objection to the depiction of the human body. How do these beings reproduce? Perhaps they use those 10 dangly things on the ends of their arms. Disgusting! The illustrations go on to detail our planet's landscapes and the variety of life on Earth, before dedicating 50 images to our lives and the civilization we've constructed, from the Great Wall of China to a supermarket. Finally, there are images of the scientific instruments we have used to explore the universe from microscopes to telescopes, including the Titan rocket that launched the voyagers into space. Chosen by a committee chaired by Carl Sagan, the disc also contains music and sounds, including human greetings in 55 languages, recordings reflecting the sounds of the Earth, and the ultimate 1977 mixtape featuring 90 minutes of music from Beethoven to Chuck Berry. Sagan wanted the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun on the disc, but EMI refused copyright permission for the universe. I like to imagine that Carl Sagan put the song on the record anyway in a great cosmic two-fingered salute to corporate Earth. That would have been pure Sagan. You're most welcome to go fetch it. The outside cover of the golden disc is more functional. As well as instructions on how to play back the images and sounds at precisely 16 2/3 revolutions per minute for the audio, and how to build a record player, it also contains a map, so that any extraterrestrial civilization will be able to trace the record back to our planet. The map uses the position of 14 pulsars whose precise locations are marked relative to the sun. The pulsars are identified by their fingerprints. Each has a unique and unvarying rate of rotation. The most important piece of content on the cover is the key to unlock the information, a diagram illustrating the spin configurations of a hydrogen atom. The 21-centimeter hydrogen emission line is a fundamental and universal property of nature, a Rosetta Stone that will allow an alien scientist to unlock the secrets of Earth. The disc also contains one last invisible source of information. Electroplated onto the surface of the cover is an ultra-pure sample of uranium-238, an isotope with a half-life of 4.468 billion years. This is Voyager's clock, a way for any civilization to determine the age of the record, assuming that they aren't creationists who disagree with radiometric dating. Perhaps these are the sort of aliens that would also be offended by nudity. For all the thought and care that went into these disks, neither Voyager spacecraft is heading towards any particular star. These tiny craft constructed by human hands will almost certainly never be found. The vastness of space swallows travellers, and of course Voyager scientists and engineers knew this. That, however, is not the point. The act of launching these gilded emissaries into space expresses something important. It's my childhood science fiction dream of living in a Star Wars galaxy filled with life and possibilities. It is a desire to reach out to others, to attempt contact, even when the chances are vanishingly small, a wish not to be alone. The golden disks are futile and yet filled with hope, the hope that we may one day know the boundaries of our loneliness and lay to rest the unsettling internal noise that accompanies the enduring silence. Friends of space, how are you all? Have you eaten yet? Come visit us if you have time. Margaret Suk Ching, Voyager Golden Record. Alien Worlds. Let us now return to Frank Drake's equation and use it as intended, as a framework to address in a systematic manner the question of our solitude. Recall that the equation consists of a series of terms which, when multiplied together, give an estimate of the number of currently contactable civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. At the 1961 Green Bank meeting, only the first term, the rate of star formation in the Milky Way, was known with any precision. Over half a century later, we can do much better. The next term in the equation is the fraction of stars in the Milky Way that have planets orbiting around them, most definitely a prerequisite for an intelligent civilization to emerge. It's true that the civilization may not have remained confined to its home world, and we will discuss this possibility later on, but it must be true that for life to emerge and evolve to the point where it can build spacecraft, a planet of some sort is required. This space we declare to be infinite. In it are an infinity of worlds of the same kind as our own. Giordano Bruno, 1584. The existence of alien worlds has been speculated about for many centuries. Ever since Copernicus began the process of demoting our solar system from its preferred place in the cosmos, it has been natural to assume that at least some of the stars in the sky must have planetary systems. Yet despite this seemingly common-sense conclusion, reached by virtually every right-thinking astronomer from Giordano Bruno onwards, the existence of other planets remained nothing more than an educated guess well into my lifetime. The vast distances between the stars and the limitations of technology locked us inside our own solar system with no way of seeing beyond. Throughout the 19th century, a number of astronomers claimed to have detected distant planets, but all these observations proved to be flawed. Today, the picture couldn't be more different. The night sky is known to be awash with worlds. One of the more enticing of the known solar systems is located around a slightly smaller, cooler version of our sun called Kepler-62. Around 1,200 light-years from Earth in the constellation of Lyra, the system has been widely studied because it has at least five planets. Two of them, Kepler-62e and Kepler-62f, are particularly interesting because they are Earth-like in both size and distance from the star. Bathed in Kepler-62 shine, these worlds may, if they have the right atmospheric conditions, support oceans of liquid water on their surfaces. We will discuss the significance of this in the context of life later on. The discovery of extrasolar planets has been possible due to the rapid development of precision astronomical instruments, both space-based and terrestrial, that allow us to see beyond the bright glare of stars to the worlds that lie in the shadows. Imagine looking at our solar system from the nearest star system to Earth, Alpha Centauri. The system is 4.37 light-years away and consists of two sun-like stars, one slightly more massive than the other, orbiting each other with a period of approximately 80 years. The red dwarf Proxima Centauri is probably a distant, gravitationally bound component of the system, making it a loosely bound triple star. Looking back towards Earth from 40 trillion kilometers with the naked eye, our sun would look like any other solitary star. Detecting exoplanets is no easy task because planets are vanishingly small and faint, masked by the brightness of their parent stars, and directly imaging them remains a major technical challenge. To step out of the glare has required the development of indirect methods of detection based on surprisingly sensitive technologies. On the 21st of April 1992, the first conclusive detection of an exoplanet was made by radio astronomers Alexander Vorschun and Dale Frail, working at the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico. They were hunting for planets around a pulsar known as PSR 1257 plus 12, located 1,000 light-years from Earth, using a delicate method of indirect observation known as pulsar timing. Pulsars are spinning neutron stars, some of the most exotic objects in the universe. PSR 1257 plus 12 is 50% more massive than our Sun, but has a radius of just over 10 kilometers. It is, in effect, a giant atomic nucleus, spinning on its axis every 0.006219 seconds. That's 9,650 RPM. As you may gather from this rather precise statement, it's possible to measure the spin rates of pulsars with great precision by timing the interval between pulses of radio waves emitted from the stars like a lighthouse. Vorschun and Frail reasoned that if a large enough planet was orbiting a pulsar, the gravitational tug should shift the arrival times of the radio pulses by enough to be detectable. And sure enough, they found two planets orbiting PSR 1257 plus 12 and measured their masses and orbits. Planet A has a mass of 0.020 times the mass of Earth and orbits the star once every 25.262 days. Planet B is 4.3 times the mass of Earth and orbits once every 66.5419 days. Subsequently, a third planet has been discovered with a mass of 3.9 times that of Earth and orbiting every 98.2114 days. Pulsar astronomy is indeed a precision science. This was an historic observation, but of limited direct interest to SETI, since there is absolutely no chance that life could survive the hostile environment around such a violent astronomical object. It was, however, an existence proof, the first discovery of planets beyond our solar system, and a surprising one at that. To search for Earth-like planets around Sun-like stars required the development of different but equally beautiful methods of observation. The first of these to be deployed was the radial velocity method. A star doesn't sit still at the center of a solar system with planets orbiting around it. Rather, the star and planets orbit around their common center of mass. The center of mass of a solar system with a single star will always be inside the star itself, because it carries virtually all of the mass, but the star will still wobble around the center of mass of the system as seen from Earth. This planetary-induced wobble is small but measurable. In our solar system, Jupiter causes our Sun to wobble backwards and forwards with a velocity change of approximately 12.4 meters per second across a period of 12 years. The Earth's effect is minute in comparison, inducing a velocity change of just 0.1 meters per second over a period of a year. In the 1950s, future Green Bank pioneer Otto Struve suggested that such a planetary-induced wobble could be detected using the Doppler effect. When a star moves towards the Earth, its light is shifted towards the blue part of the spectrum, and when it moves away from the Earth, its light is shifted towards the red part of the spectrum. By making measurements of the specific frequencies, i.e. colors of light absorbed by chemical elements in the star's atmosphere, and measuring how much these are shifted relative to the known frequencies as measured here on Earth, the motion of the star backwards and forwards can be determined over a period of time, and this can be used to calculate the orbital period of the planet and to estimate its mass. If there's more than one planet, the motion of the star will be more complicated, but since the orbital periods of the planets are regular, the contributions of the different planets to the star's wobble can be figured out. Struve was one of the first respected scientists to publicly state his belief in extraterrestrial life. In the 1950s, however, the spectrographs used to measure red and blue shift were only able to detect velocity changes of a few thousand meters per second, and at the Green Bank meeting, he could only speculate that his technique would one day confirm his prejudice that planetary systems are common. Struve didn't live long enough to see his method applied, dying just 2 years after Green Bank, long before technology caught up with his ambition. It took until 1995 for two Swiss astronomers, Michel Mayor and Didier Queloz, to detect a planetary-induced Doppler shift using the Observatoire de Haute-Provence in France. The team discovered a planet orbiting the sun-like star 51 Pegasi, located 50.9 light-years from Earth. This planet is named 51 Pegasi b, but its nickname is Bellerophon, after the mythological Greek hero who rode Pegasus, the winged stallion. Since its historic discovery, Bellerophon has been observed and examined in quite some detail, and it is no second Earth. It is a deeply hostile world, orbiting its parent star every 4 Earth days, on a trajectory that takes it far closer than Mercury approaches our own sun. Unlike Mercury, Bellerophon is a gas giant planet, with a mass 150 times that of the Earth, and a surface temperature approaching 1,000 degrees Celsius. Although only half the mass of Jupiter, it may have a greater radius because the high surface temperature causes it to swell. Such exoplanets are known as hot Jupiters, big enough and close enough to cause a significant wobble in their parent stars, which is why these types of worlds were discovered first by the early planet hunters. The first evidence of a potential Earth-like planet arrived in 2007, when Stéphane Audrey and his team at the European Southern Observatory in Chile announced the discovery of a planet around the red dwarf star Gliese 581, just over 20 light-years from Earth. This was the second planet to be discovered in this system, but Gliese 581c made headline news around the world because of its apparent Earth-like qualities. This planet is a rocky world, about 5 times as massive as Earth, and possibly the right distance away from its parent star to support liquid water on the surface, the stuff out of which science fiction dreams are made. Further research has cast doubt on the idea that Gliese 581b might have the necessary conditions to support life, but in March 2009, the second Earth hunters got their own dedicated scientific instrument, and with it, a cascade of new data became available. The Kepler Space Telescope has transformed our knowledge of the distribution of planets in the Milky Way. Kepler is not a general-purpose instrument with multiple detectors and myriad ambitions. The telescope was designed for one purpose, to look for Earth-like planets. Free of the distorting effects of the Earth's atmosphere, Kepler carries a high-precision photometer, an instrument that has measured the light intensity from over 100,000 stars, considered stable enough to support life on planets around them. Kepler searches for planets using a technique known as the transit method. If a planet passes across the face of a star, as seen from Earth, the observed brightness of the star will drop by the tiniest of margins. Kepler's photometer is so sensitive it can measure changes in brightness, to use precise astronomical language, we should say changes in the apparent magnitude, of less than 0.01%. Observing repeated dips in brightness allows the orbital period of the planet to be measured, and the details of the changes in the brightness, combined with knowledge of the orbit, allows the size and mass of the planetary candidate to be estimated. The transit method has been extremely successful in the hunt for exoplanets, but the technique is not entirely reliable, often throwing up false positives. Once a promising candidate is found, the location is passed to ground-based telescopes for further analysis, and if confirmed, the planets are classified as discoveries. Kepler has used the transit method of planet hunting on a quite extraordinary scale since it became fully operational in May 2009. As I write in July 2014, NASA's Exoplanet Archive lists 1,737 confirmed planets, over 50% of which have been discovered using the Kepler data. This number is all the more staggering because Kepler is only capable of detecting a very small number of the planetary systems in our galaxy. Kepler views around 0.3% of the sky in the constellations of Cygnus, Lyra, and Draco. And even in this small patch, the telescope can only detect planets that pass directly in between their parent star and Earth. If the plane of the planetary orbits is orientated at the wrong angle, which is more likely than not, Kepler will not see any planets. Furthermore, Kepler only observed for 4 years, and because it has to see more than one transit to measure an orbit, it is blind to planets that orbit with periods greater than 4 years, which is the case for all the outer planets in our solar system. And finally, Kepler only sees stars out to a distance of approximately 3,000 light-years, whilst our galaxy has a diameter of 100,000 light-years. Kepler's data set, then, contains only a tiny fraction of the planetary systems out there. All of these losses can be corrected for in a statistical sense, and when the numbers are crunched, we have a reliable observation-based number to put into the Drake equation. The fraction of stars that have planetary systems is close to 100%. On average, there is at least one planet per star in the Milky Way galaxy, and we can insert the second term with confidence. FP equals 1. The extraordinary Kepler mission was expected to last until 2016, but technical malfunctions may mean the telescope has now finished its planet-hunting activity. Even so, the huge volume of data is still being worked through, and indications suggest it may have captured evidence for up to 3,000 more planets circling distant stars. This is encouraging for SETI enthusiasts, but in the hunt for civilizations, it's not the number of planets out there that really matters.